Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Christ is risen. This is the Paschal week, April 10th, 2018. I ask again my supporters and listeners to support this show financially. I have a new way of donating to this show and mission on my website, rushjournal.org. In fact, PayPal has developed a much better way and more stable and more secure way of donating. And I have that on my site. And it's on the archives that Sven Longshanks has been so gracious to put together for me as a part of. I also have those archives linked on my website as well. So I really thank you, and I appreciate that very much. I've been asked to do a show on the opiate epidemic in America, which is odd because it's not exactly something I talk about a lot. But then I realized, wait a minute, there is nothing more relevant than the auto-destruction of the New World Order and the rise of true orthodoxy than what the West is doing to itself and where it's coming from. This is connected with Russia, of course, with nationalism. There's a clear good and evil here. And frankly, I never pass up an opportunity to make fun of, to delegitimize, and to destroy the morale of the American military. The war in Afghanistan has been lost. There's enough generals saying this now to make it clear. There were no clear goals, no competent leadership, and certainly no understanding of the country. The United States, as always, is an imperial country seeking to control this mineral wealth, which is tremendous, potential oil pipelines, and of course, the drugs. Now, I'm no friend of Islam. I'll never be. But barring a massive miraculous conversion to orthodoxy, the only realistic solution is the Taliban. The Taliban are good men, in relative to Afghanistan. They understand one simple truth, that when you have a society ripped to pieces by war, the morale and the morality disappears. What you need to rebuild it is a very strong, very strict state and a very simple moral code. And that's what they offer. Some of you might have noticed the Taliban website made an offer, and I had to read this three times to find it. They made it before, but they made an offer relative to the opiate epidemic in America and Western Europe, and they said, get out of Afghanistan. You've already admitted you lost. We'll let you have some of the minerals and the pipelines. We won't discriminate against you for that. We'll torch all of the poppy fields like we did in 96. And you guys can still claim victory. You could say that the Taliban are working for us now or something like that. The Taliban are very concerned with, you know, saving face, a very Asian thing. And of course the U.S. had no response. And I said, the stupidity here, the Taliban just gave the United States a way out of this mess such that it could destroy the drug epidemic, bring peace to the country, and still claim victory. They offered him a way out that had the Americans able to save face, and they said no. So any American who dies, right, anybody who dies now because of this war has been murdered. Now, I know they've made this offer before, but of course the Taliban's position is my position, and that is that the U.S., one of the reasons the U.S. is there is to make sure the drugs keep flowing. Only a tiny percentage of the acreage of poppies being grown now is necessary for the legitimate drug, Oxycontin and everything else. The rest is illegitimate. Now, of course, the border between illegitimate and legitimate is very thin. I mean, I had a botched root canal several years ago, and I was prescribed oxycodone. And the first day I took it, I said, oh my God, I know why people get addicted to this stuff now. It was tremendous. I loved it. Thank God I never got into it until I realized. I said, this is, and then your mood swings. You get very depressed afterwards, so you want more. And it's so easy to get caught up in it. And this is why it's, so the legitimate drugs, you know, made by pharmaceutical companies are often, you know, sold illegitimately anyway. And so the line between, you know, legitimate and illegitimate is very, very thin. Heroin is fairly difficult to make, and the labs are mostly in Latin America now. And so the raw poppy is shipped down there, and then they ship it through Mexico relative to the United States. To get it into Europe, they of course go through Georgia and Albania. Both countries firmly in NATO's grasp, which is not an accident. As I said on this show before, Albania's entire existence is as a facilitator of girls and drugs from Afghanistan into Europe under the nose of the U.S. military, Kosovo in particular, and Camp Bondsteel. Now, what makes this loss even more pathetic is American politicians. You even have military guys making excuses. Now, I've not known tough guys to make excuses. Now it's Pakistan's fault. They've been supporting the Taliban, God forbid. Therefore, American loss is their fault. Well, it still doesn't sound like a superpower to me. I don't remember the Americans blaming the USSR for their loss in Vietnam. Then they blame their rules of engagement, which I remember them blaming in Vietnam. Well, given the fact they leveled much of North Vietnam with bombs, that's a very weak excuse. For almost 20 years, the most powerful military force in the world, allegedly, lost badly again against a loosely organized but motivated group of militants. When do military men make excuses for it? When did this start happening? The U.S. is not a military superpower by any stretch of the imagination. It's a paper tiger. The green Americans, the video game soaked Americans coming in from Iowa and Florida are coming up against experienced Mujahideen who actually have something to fight for. They're not there to get their college paid for, to get laid. They're there to fight for their country. And if you want to have fun, I said this before on the Daily Nationalist, go look at the fails of the Afghan National Army. First of all, they're mostly on drugs. They're the outcasts of society. That's why they join the Americans. They'll be shot if they ever went home. They get yelled at all the time. They don't know how to do push-ups. I mean, it's a joke. So they've lost at every level. And yet, for some reason, the U.S. military remains worshipped in American society. Now, 30 years ago, the opposite was true. So what's changed? Only the enemy has changed. Now nationalism is the target, and liberalism is the result. Suddenly, the troops become heroes. But you have, I think, the overwhelming majority of Americans who still think it's 1960, and that the U.S. military is a conservative institution. It is not. It's anything but a conservative institution. The Air Force, or the Chair Force, is the most liberal, and it goes straight down to the Marine Corps at the most conservative. Now, here's the truth. Gay pride days are mandatory on all U.S. military bases. Go to any base website, and they'll tell you. All these walk-in-her-shoes feminist rituals are also required. Diversity Day celebrations are done at least twice a year. Shriver Air Base, for example, runs the headline, Diversity Day showcases variety of cultures. The military is liberalism's armed wing. The Washington Times has a whole article, the armed forces plan to celebrate LGBT Pride Month. The Defense Department came out in June 2nd, 2017. Observing June as Gay Pride Month is mandatory. It's helped shape our history, they say, and it reminds us to uphold tolerance and justice for all. And the man who said that was Anthony Curta, who was a career federal government executive and bureaucrat, who back then was filling in as Undersecretary of Defense for personnel and readiness. This is what the U.S. imposes on nations that it invades. But it gets worse than this, because according to the Pentagon, reports of sexual assault from active duty personnel went from, well, about 3,000 in 2011 to 3,500 in 2012. Now, the real number is about 30,000. And that's only for the Marine Corps. Now, that comes from the Pentagon using anonymous sources, but only about 10% or even less are actually tried, and very few lead to convictions. Word on the street is Camp Leatherneck in Afghanistan is simply a prostitute haven. And I know that Camp Bondsteel had a Thai massage parlor added to it. Actually, not added to it. It was part of the initial, the Serbian government ran several stories on that. So beyond its behavior, though, they're fueled by public worship. And this public worship leads these guys to consider themselves invincible. But they're finding out just how pathetic they really are. Now, their equipment crisis is just getting, where are these trillions of dollars going? As of right now, about half of the Navy's jets can't fly. The Air Force is down about 2,000 pilots. Much of its firepower is now grounded. Morale is an all-time low. Desertion is an all-time high, at least since the Civil War. You have major defense analysts saying that, you know, these dollars or trillions went into Afghanistan may well have been burned. The evaluation now of the Joint Chiefs of Staff talks about utter defeat. The authorization for the use of military force brought no lasting stability to nor advance of any U.S. interests in this part of the world. Well, I disagree with that, because this is American interest. Keep the drugs flowing, keep the war machine moving. When the ISIS army, which is just American proxies, they overran parts of Iraq last year. The Iraqi National Army just laid down their weapons and ran, or joined ISIS. U.S. advisors poured millions into their training. Over 5 years, total miserable failure. The motivated and hardened Taliban easily defeated the Afghan National Army. They failed miserably. The most optimistic I've heard, I think General Mattis said the war's a stalemate. Well, the U.S. can't call itself a superpower if it can't win a war like this. The American fighting man is lost because he's the occupying army, and the Taliban are patriots. He's been defeated. Yet tens of thousands of medals have been given out anyway. Now, the U.S. lies about its casualties there, too. Now, this is common. Most countries lie about their casualties. But the count is KIA, a soldier or a Marine, they have to die in front of everybody. They have to have witnesses. Many KIA actually are listed as wounded. Correspondence is massively censored. Many KIA are listed as having drowned or something like that, or killed in an accident. The U.S., in Asia, has this bizarre practice of shuffling the wounded from one hospital to another, back and forth. The purpose of which, of course, is, the losses will increase because care goes down. But then it makes verifying death very tricky. The New York Times reports that all war data, including casualties, is censored by the Pentagon. The Pakistani newspaper, Frontier Post, reported that over 3,000 U.S. soldiers were killed in Afghanistan the first 2 years alone. Yet the Pentagon will admit to only 3,500 total since 2001 to now. And don't forget, private contractors don't count. And, you know, the very fact, the artificiality of all this, where is the anti-war movement? When communists were the enemies, and the U.S. military was a more or less conservative institution, you had anti-war protests at every city, at every university. Now, for a war that's lasted for 20 years, more than that, there is nothing of the kind. There is no anti-war movement at all. Now, this strongly suggests to me that these movements are created by the ruling class. I want to make a clear distinction here. The ruling class and the government are two very different things. In Vietnam, the government was fighting the war there. The ruling class hated it. And this is what happens. You have the government fighting it, then you have the ruling class at home doing everything it can to destroy it. Now, why was this war waged? I mean, we know about the drug element here, but for now, people often forget the massive, huge veins of iron, copper, cobalt, gold, critical metals like lithium, they're huge, huge veins. There's an internal Pentagon memo that was declassified using the Freedom of Information Act, saying that Afghanistan could be the Saudi Arabia of lithium. This is the key raw material for batteries and for laptops. You know, this vast scale of Afghanistan's mineral wealth was discovered by a small team of Pentagon officials, but the Soviets knew about this too. They determined all this in the 70s. And so the U.S. was aware of it then because the U.S. and Soviet Union was trading very briskly back then in this alleged Cold War. ISIS, of course, is an American proxy. You don't have the draft, so what happens is you need mercenary soldiers, proxy armies, and these are going to be doing a lot of the fighting. All of a sudden, why in heaven's name would ISIS be fighting the Taliban? I mean, this is very far out of their area anyway. Well, don't forget, as soon as Duterte and the Philippines clamp down on drugs there, all of a sudden, ISIS shows up in Islamic areas of the Philippines. And if anyone thinks that ISIS is an independently created force, you're a moron. Now, the Russian special envoy, Zmir Kabulov, said that back on February 1st, about 7,000 ISIS mercenaries were active in Afghanistan. And they have a very formalized structure. Now, the Taliban, well, I'm not sure why they would be fighting each other, but the Taliban fields a force of about 60,000 battle-hardened soldiers. But the ISIS have not come. The Russians have been very clear on this. They're fighting the Taliban, and they're protecting the drug trade. That's odd. Special advisor on international affairs, the Iranian parliament, Hossein Abdullahian, said this. When Mosul in Iraq was under the Daesh occupation, an American A330 landed at Mosul airport. American generals got off the plane, and military equipment was unloaded. At the airport's VIP lounge, the American generals talked with ISIS leaders in Mosul for about 3 hours, 3.5 hours, then boarded the plane and returned. I don't remember if that's a translation from me or not, but this has been the Russian official position, and they would know. They go where the U.S. either can't go or has failed. The chaos of the post-war environment, I'm talking about the Soviet invasion, that failure, it created a power vacuum. You know, Afghanistan has the potential of being an extraordinarily wealthy country, but it's just not allowed. It's never been colonized, never a colony of the great powers, only temporarily, very brief periods of time. The Taliban comes up as a fairly legitimate, autonomous body with Pakistani assistance, under the Mullah Muhammad Omar in 94. And their purpose was to help guard trans-border trade with Pakistan. To get rid of the warlords, get rid of these guys who were taking advantage. His purpose and promise was to get rid of criminals that had come into prominence after the Soviet withdrawal. But they did have an eye for business. By the mid-1990s, they had at least 30,000 men, and Pakistan was very interested in setting them up as a state there. In 98, Iran accused Pakistan of sending its air force to bomb Zarqa Sharif in support of the Taliban forces. Iran claimed that Pakistan sent a large contingent of soldiers and advisors, some of whom had been taken prisoner by anti-Taliban United Front soldiers. That's a Northern Alliance created by the CIA. The Saudis also made common cause with Pakistan in this regard, because they saw Afghanistan and Taliban as a counterweight to the Shia factions in Iraq and in Iran. Now, it's something, a myth has to be dispelled here. There was very little converse between Osama bin Laden and the Taliban. The Taliban wanted to put him on trial long before 9/11. He brought Western pressure on their government. They only sought the stabilization of Afghanistan. He was seen as a very arrogant troublemaker. Osama's bombings prior to 9/11 were so crude, they're nowhere near the sophistication of 9/11. Osama was in no position to mastermind anything. He was on dialysis in Pakistan at the time. And I think he was the only military leader out there to say that he didn't do it. I don't know if you've seen the fake video saying that he did it, which is laughable. The guy in there looks like Osama, but is much heavier. And he's not as sick as Osama bin Laden was. Osama bin Laden died a long time ago. U.S. Navy SEALs did not kill him. No one's seen the body. There's no autopsy. It's nonsense. It was a bogus story to create further interest in the war. Something had to happen. They needed an event to keep it going. But the Afghanistan news agency, the Taliban news agency, said long before the attacks of 9/11, the Islamic Emirate, which is what the Taliban call themselves, they've tried many ways to resolve the Osama issue. They wanted to create a three-nation court under the Organization of Islamic Conference, OIC, but the U.S. rejected it. The U.S. just wanted him to hand them over, but there was no official relations with the U.S. at the time. They didn't recognize the Taliban, so nothing happened. It was just American imperial arrogance. Robert Grenier, the CIA station chief in Pakistan at the time of 9/11, confirmed this, and then he said the offer had definitely been made by the Taliban. Yet another attempt at the Taliban to speak reason to the U.S. government. There is precisely zero evidence that Osama had anything to do with the events of 9/11. These events only benefited the U.S. war machine and ensure the continual presence of U.S. soldiers in Islamic territory. How anyone can see this as a rational action for Osama or anyone is a mystery, and the Taliban condemned 9/11. And they condemned it vehemently as an attack against innocent civilians. Their ambassador to Pakistan, Abdul Zaif, he said just a few days before 9/11, he said the Taliban don't see Americans as their enemies. There are no threats to Americans coming from the Taliban. Nonetheless, we'll do our best to follow up and stop any threat with regard to bin Laden or anyone else. And this was kept for the American population. But when the Taliban finally took power in 96, and you had a functional government for once, there was little running water, little electricity, few phones, very few functioning roads. Necessities, water, food, housing, were destroyed or very low quality. The casualties of the war destroyed the local family and clan structure. There was no formation. Afghanistan's infant mortality rate was the highest 25%, a full quarter, of their kids died before the age of 5. Pakistan saw, and common sense saw, the Taliban finally, as a group of people, Pashtun though they were, to see order, commerce, legitimate commerce, and an end to the drug trade come to Afghanistan. They did seek, as which makes a lot of sense, the purification of the country. It needed to be purified. The voice of Sharia, they broadcast November 5th, 1996. The Taliban said this. The Taliban, referring to themselves, we emerged from the masses to deliver their compatriots from pain and hardship, to ensure complete peace and security across the country by collecting weapons, doing away with feudal principalities here and there in the country, and by creating a powerful Islamic government in Afghanistan. The liberal state failed to adhere to the standards expected of all of an Islamic state. By the liberal state, he's referring to the state that the U.S. set up. Sharia law is popular in most of the country, especially where you have very little else. The Taliban was firmly nationalist, and they had a very simple view. I mean, the simple people could comprehend it. They had no choice but to centralize power. If things were normal and the clan structure at the local level was working, that would be another matter. But that's been damaged so badly, which itself created a vacuum. And so now you had mafioso-style groups connected to every country on the globe developing. Taliban were and are popular. The first few weeks of Taliban rule, the markets in the country actually grew. They imposed a 50% tax on any country operating in the country, any company operating in the country that had a foreign back. They wanted local capital, but little there was. They imposed a 6% tariff on anything brought into the country. By 1998, they had control of the major airports and border crossings. By 2001, the per capita income of 25 million people was under $200. But the economy recovered with substantial gold reserves, a 13% increase in economic growth per year, which is estimated under their rule. They delivered the goods. They were the legitimate government, and they had no incentive to irritate the U.S. You had a cross-border turnover between Afghanistan and Pakistan at those days, $3 billion a year. And protecting this trade was a source of Taliban income. So they didn't need the poppies. They'd torch them, and they'd go into a village, they'd put a gun to the guy's head and say, if you grow these poppies again, we're going to blow your brains out. Generally speaking, it worked. So they won their drug war in a week or so. In the southern part of the country, they completely cleared it of bandit organizations. And because they needed to really consolidate wealth, they banned all forms of ostentation, like men wearing gold or silk or anything like that. They say that luxurious living leads to weakness among nations, the downfall of nations. They say the existence of luxury is an expression of social injustice, because only a few can afford that. And these items are bought at the expense of the deprived masses of the people, and they're absolutely correct. Their condemnations of luxury focus on their inherently corrupting quality. They rejected any kind of expensive, needless parties, you know, $3,000 a plate dinners. Not when Afghanistan is dying. However, they're not an isolationist group. Washington turned on them. I mean, there was some flirtation with the Taliban. Then they banned and jammed all American media coming into the country. But they had something else. They developed a local banking system that didn't need paperwork. It's called Hawala. Now, the Hawala system makes estimating their economic growth very difficult. If you go to the World Bank data section on Afghanistan, where the Taliban ruled, there's just a blank. And part of the reason for this is that banking there was strictly Islamic, and you had this informal web of Hawala brokers. It's based on the honor system. And there, you know, we don't have functional institutions. Your word is gold. It has to be. No paper exists at all. It's based on morality rather than power. And believe it or not, it can operate even in the absence of Western oversight. And it's very attractive to customers. It's a fast, easy transfer of funds with much lower commissions than charged by regime's banks. And you can't really bet on the currency within this system. The transaction cost is almost zero. So these are the things that irritated the Americans. Mineral wealth, the Taliban were quite willing to negotiate with the U.S. for. The Taliban were willing to negotiate with the U.S. for the oil and gas pipelines. The drugs, however, they said no. And they torched them. How ironic it is that the American media says that the Taliban are making their money from opiates. Well, the punishment for dealing or having or even thinking about heroin in Afghanistan is death. So I'm pretty sure that's not how they're making their money. By 2000, those areas not under the Taliban accounted for 75% of the world supply of heroin, or opiates in general. And the U.S. simply spread rumors that the Taliban financed the war effort this way. They didn't. They financed their war effort through Pakistani aid and cross-border trade. The United Front, the CIA brokered a deal between Massoud and Dostum, who were normally enemies, but they created this Northern Alliance. Its sole purpose, really, was to protect the movement of poppies, whether it could be finished or not, the flour or the finished product, out of Afghanistan safely. The CIA was giving Massoud over $200,000 a month to organize. Again, Osama bin Laden had nothing to do with the Taliban. They were opponents. He saw the Taliban as uneducated barbarians. And Al-Qaeda was this wise cosmopolitan group, which, by the way, is now officially aligned with the U.S. and Syria. The Taliban never threatened American interests. They didn't have the capacity to threaten American interests. It is a healthy, local, nationalist force. Yes, it's Islamic. That's a shame. But again, in the absence of a miraculous conversion of the whole country, that's what we have to work with. Regardless, in 1999, Bill Clinton signed an executive order which banned all trade between America and Afghanistan. And they froze about $5 million of their assets abroad, including Afghan Airlines. And it had nothing to do with anything but the rumors of the NGOs. But talking about the government that the Americans imposed on the country, the Taliban say this. This is a letter, actually their open letter to the American population. Even though it's not the duty of America to draft laws and suggest systems for other countries to emulate. Excuse of George W. Bush for the invasion of Afghanistan was to establish a supposed legitimate government, despite 17 years, war costing thousands of American and coalition lives, billions of dollars. The system that's taken root in Afghanistan has achieved the following records. They're number one internationally in administrative and financial corruption. Number one internationally in violation of human rights. Number one internationally in usurping land and embezzling financial aid. Number one internationally in violence against women, etc., etc., etc. The latest example of the corrupt regime formed in the wake of the American invasion is the presence of a two-headed system which is unparalleled in the established laws of forming a government throughout the world. End quote. That was the Taliban's open letter to the American population. Just this year, 2018. talking about the drug trade can be very difficult with the swaggering, arrogant American patriot. The occupation forces in Afghanistan are supporting the drug trade. We're talking about almost $200 billion a year to organized crime, intelligence agencies, and Western financial institutions. The proceeds there are deposited in Western banks. The Golden Crescent drug trade, which was created by the CIA in the 80s, continues to be protected by U.S. intelligence. And there's a liaison with NATO and the British military as well. The British occupation forces have promoted opium cultivation. There's paid radio advertisements out there. They assured local farmers that the NATO-led International Security Assistance Force will not interfere with poppy fields currently being harvested. They said explicitly, respected people of Helmand, an area of Afghanistan, the soldiers of ISAF and ANA do not destroy poppy fields. We know that many people of Afghanistan have no choice but to grow this. We don't want to stop people from earning their livelihoods. That was straight from the British military early on in the occupation. The swaggering, tough guy American soldiers and airmen, they march home to parades while the world is flooded with opiates they made possible. The market is now flooded with poppy derivatives used in legal painkillers and everything else you could do with it. The International Narcotics Control Board says, this was a few years ago, they said, we are overwhelmed with supply. We have more of this stuff than we could ever use. And yet, the CIA continues to pump this stuff into the Western world. The INCB even said, we need you to cut production. It's just oversupply. And yet, they still pour in. So the guys in uniform aren't so heroic anymore, are they? They are the direct cause of the opiate crisis in America. Now, of course, the addicts themselves, I mean, we could go on about that, but they make it possible and are driving down the price. I don't care how many fake bronze stars you pin on these idiots, it won't cover that fact up. Since the U.S. invasion, the amount of opiates exported from that country has grown over 21 times. I mean, the profits go to multinationals, military brass, whatever. Local farmer gets nothing. There were 189,000 heroin users in the U.S. in 2000-2001. 2016, that number went up to 4.5 million. Now, that's not all heroin, but opiate addicts. From 200,000 to 4.5 million. Deaths from heroin shot up from 1,700 in 2001 to almost 11,000 in 2014. There's a direct correlation with deaths from opiate overdoses and misuse with the lowering of the price because of supply coming in from Afghanistan. Like 7,600 hectares in 2001 have been set aside for that. Now it's almost 500,000. 1 hectare is like 2.5 acres. There's no denying then that the troops are little more than overpaid drug dealers. Oh, by the way, it's a misconception. Someone told me that the American heroin comes from Mexico. That figure only refers to the final product. Poppies from Afghanistan roughly 90% of the time. Mexico is a transit point. The UNODC says about 60% of the poppy crop in Afghanistan is made into heroin. Now, I saw, it's on YouTube, I'm looking at a Marine interviewed by Geraldo Rivera. And he says, we won't destroy the poppy crop because it'll turn the population against them. He also admitted, by the way, that they had no idea what a Taliban soldier looks like. They didn't know what a militia soldier, you know, there's all these different groups, according to them. They have no idea who's who. So when you see on the news, I just saw recently a video the U.S. Air Force put out bombing a Taliban drug lab. well, Johnson's Law, it could be anything. They don't know what they're doing. They're not going to blow up drug labs. In 2000, Mullah Omar announced a fatwa stating that poppy cultivation and opium production violated fundamental Islamic tradition. And he said explicitly, the Taliban is placing its entire reputation on eradicating that crop from the country. The punishment is death. And the ulema went, you know, at the local levels, the tribal elders, the chain of command was very, very clear here. In 2000, the Shuras, which is a monitoring group, really disseminated the information about the fatwa and its enforcement to local farmers. They were the primary enforcers of the ban, in fact. And they had local, you know, local knowledge of the poppy farming and the tradition there. And the Shuras, connected with the fatwa in the central government, were brutal. They had good knowledge of the locality, and they had a lot of accountability. And so the poppy crop disappeared. That fatwa is still in force. No Taliban member is going to break it. In 2000, the Taliban banned cultivation having anything to do. And this is according to the UN Afghanistan Annual Opium Poppy Supply Survey. This was the problem. So what irritated the Americans? Number one, jamming of American media. There's this whole big market out there, a lot of people who can't watch porn. That's a big, big problem. Number two, they had a hard line in negotiations with minerals and oil and gas pipeline. Number three, they were unbendable on drug production. So when the planes hit the Pentagon within 15 minutes, I'm sorry, hit the trade towers within 15 minutes, they were certain that Osama was behind it. And somehow, Afghanistan was then invaded. I mean, that's something like if my mother irritates me on the phone, says something terrible to me, I go to my pharmacist and punch him in the face. That's pretty much the sense there that makes. What does one have to do with the other? United Nations have been very clear. They have the manpower to show that the Taliban delivered the goods. They delivered the goods not just in terms of economic growth outside of the poppy, and showed it can be done. But destroying the drug trade. And you have the stupid headline I read from The Nation, which is a left, you know, suburban hack journal. Heroin, the drug that makes the Taliban possible. They call them a totalitarian theocratic regime. And like they're talking about suburban Baltimore. The country has been ripped to pieces since the 70s, for crying out loud. What do you think is going to happen? Well, there was something else too. Pakistan became an important mediator in the construction of two huge pipelines, the American Unocal and the Saudi Delta Oil. But talk about $4 billion a year worth of supply here. Unocal, as you know, is heavy. Their lobbying efforts in Washington are heavy. And Washington gave Islamabad pretty much the green light to go forward in supporting the Taliban, or pretty much whoever would centralize and give order and peace to the society. And Washington's line at the time was that, oh, they're a traditional Islamic group. They're good. They're moderate. Saudi Delta served as a mediator for the financing. The supplies included hundreds and hundreds of Toyota pickup trucks. Now, the role of America was vague until there was a BBC interview. Benazir Bhutto in Pakistan admitted way too much, explaining that the government had trained Taliban forces in Pakistan with indirect American financial assistance. So there was a time up until 2001, that the U.S. was quite interested in assisting. And really, knowledge of the area is not a big strong point in Washington. Now remember, capital usually likes a weak liberal state, a republic. You can easily penetrate that and manipulate. They hate military governments because they're usually very patriotic and often nationalize strategic industry. Afghanistan was a special problem because at least in the short term, the Islamic government had to have been sufficient. Now, it was clear that eventually, once stability was brought to the country, that the CIA would overthrow it and put, you know, one of their hacks in. I mean, you know, why do they tolerate Saudi Arabia? Well, despite the fact that it's a monarchy, they're very easy to manipulate. They know how to play the game. But that's an exception to the rule. So in 2001, there's an Indian writer who said the following. Not only can Afghanistan play a role in hosting pipelines connecting Central Asia to international markets, but the country itself has significant oil and gas deposits. During the Soviet's decade-long occupation of Afghanistan, Moscow estimated Afghanistan's proven and probable natural gas reserves at around 5 trillion cubic feet, and production reached 275 million cubic feet per day in the 70s. But sabotage by the anti-Soviet Mujahideen and by rival groups in the Civil War that followed the Soviet withdrawal in 1989 closed down gas production and ended deals for the supply of gas to European countries. This was the general point of view prior to 9/11. There are many advantages to the Afghan route. It would terminate in the Arabian Sea, which is a lot closer to than the Persian Gulf or northern China, the key Asian markets. The pipeline becomes crucial for American oil firms. It would allow them to sell their oil in an expanding and highly prospective Asian market. The profits there would be much higher than the European market. But it was clear that the construction of these routes can only begin when an internationally recognized government is formed in Afghanistan. So the invasion of Afghanistan makes sense and has absolutely no relation to the events of 9/11. 9/11 gave a wonderful excuse. I mean, the very day the planes hit 9/11, the Israeli government sent an army into both the West Bank and the Gaza Strip to pacify the country, pacify those areas. They were waiting there. It gave them an excuse to cover to do whatever they wanted. But these campaigns have all failed. Afghanistan moves closer to the ever-popular Taliban. And the West now is picking fights it can't win with Russia and China. And I'm going to say something out here. You know, it's an odd thing to say, and you can't prove it, really. But if you consider the United States a person, it would be extremely depressed, absolutely soaked in drugs. The mind would be completely disordered. It would have no unifying thought process or purpose. It wouldn't be able to see straight. Suicide might be its only option. Well, picking a war with China and Russia is a national form of suicide. The U.S. is killing itself financially and militarily. At a very deep level, a deep psychological level, the ruling class is doing just that. I get very irritated when I hear that the United States is a military superpower. It is the precise opposite of a military superpower. It's lost pretty much wherever it's gone. I guess the only victories have been Panama and Grenada, which are very fast. You know, there was no resistance in any of these places. But the minute someone picks up a gun, the U.S. is defeated. The U.S. bit up far more than it can chew. They're fed propaganda. The United States possessed invincible militaries. Politicians used it to line their own pockets. And troops really are bodyguards for the ruling class. So the arrogant U.S. soldier has a chest full of medals, and he is defeated. The Taliban have proven themselves to be the most rational alternative to Afghanistan reconstruction. They offer a simple, strict regime that would destroy the drug trade and work closely with Pakistan to build a inter-Islamic trade and banking system based on their Hawala regime. The Taliban is victorious because in truth, really, they are, especially in the 90s, they were very tightly organized and well-funded. They weren't, as is so often the case in these areas, loosely organized bands of guerrillas. The Taliban forces, though they don't wear uniforms, are very tightly organized, almost like the Soviet Communist Party in the 20s. Very strict ideology, strict chain of command, and it's proven by the fact they could do away with the poppies in a few weeks. People have called Afghanistan the graveyard of empires. Now we have two more. We have the USSR and now the USA. France loses in Vietnam. The U.S. goes in right afterwards and has the same problem. The Soviets lose in Afghanistan. The U.S. goes right in, same problem. Why? The U.S. military acted arrogantly. They assumed that they were the vanguard of a superior civilization. Sometimes I feel sorry for them. A lot of these green soldiers from Iowa and Texas go over to a place they know nothing about, and they're told that they are invincible. They're told that they are part of the most extraordinary, powerful military the world has ever seen. They're worshipped by everybody. They're paid very well. Women throw themselves at them. Their college is paid for. We go on and on and on and on. And they get there, and they're ripped to pieces. Yeah, I enjoy mocking the arrogance of the American military, but I don't enjoy what it's done to these kids. I'm talking about the grunts now, the ones that actually matter. They're going over there with this propaganda, being told that the population is going to come running out to welcome them. It doesn't matter anyway because they're invincible. They're part of the American military. Who could beat them, right? And they get torn to shreds. That's the nature of this ruling class. And yet, for reasons beyond my understanding, the overwhelming majority of the American population sees the military as competent, as conservative, and as somehow bringing about some sort of conservative movement wherever they go and occupy. The evidence is in front of them. They lose all the time. The last victory of any import was against the Japanese. And Japan in the 40s did not have the capacity of a war of attrition. Their industrial output was smashed pretty quickly. Japan's the size of California. When you get death benefits from the U.S. military, you sign a non-disclosure agreement. You can't talk about it. I don't like, as much as I make fun of the American military, I do not like, and I will not poke fun at what happens to these boys. They're no girls, by the way. They're boys. They're all male. They're females, as nurses and stuff like that. But in combat, they're all men. So stop saying men and women all the time. It's just crap. 99.99999% of all military deaths are male. It's not men and women of the U.S. military. It's the men who are doing the fighting. The men, boys in some cases, of the U.S. military, are being lied to and sent over there and picked off one by one. And worse than that, one of the worst tortures imaginable, being told they have to train the Afghan National Army. Which is a torture, really, that even Stalin, couldn't come up with. Oh, and I should note, I can't believe this is happening. I guess there's this unexplained naivete in my personality. I still get surprised by this stuff. There is yet another claim that the Assad regime has gassed its opponents. They're not even trying anymore. I mean, this is one of the reasons I think that, you know, this, we're really talking about this deep psychological need to kill themselves. Assad has won the war. He's won. He's extremely popular. He's in the process of reconstruction. You know, I mean, everything's changing now. I mean, the pressure's off. And that's when he decides to gas people? That's the level. That's the level of it. I really don't have a comment about it because I don't have to argue that, really. Do I? It's moronic. The idiotic claim is that there is a tiny handful, a toehold, that the regime, that is the Western regime, has in Syria, using Al-Qaeda and ISIS as proxies, and set it in the town of Ghouta. And I'm hearing the argument that even though they're surrounded, even though they're utterly defeated, even though, you know, they're not popular even there, he will get, the logic here is so bad. And you have this halfwit General Mattis, you know, the dumb jock that's read a couple of books. He gets on and talks about the obvious and clear responsibility of the Assad regime. I have a book out on American failures in the Mideast on Ramada Press. The book's title is The Foreign Policy of Mass Society, The Failure of Western Engagement in the Islamic World. It's relatively brief, even though the topic, you know, should be a very large book, but I want to keep it manageable. It's substantial, and it deals with this sort of thing, not just from the point of view of what we were talking about here, the military and political stuff, but the spiritual element as well. It's often the case that ideology and spiritual things are left to the side. And everything is based on dollars and cents and guns and bullets. But yes, those are very powerful. But history is driven by fanatical minorities. And what makes those minorities powerful? What the Taliban has. What the Communist Party of the Soviet Union had. What the New Left had in the mid-60s. A simple, powerful message, true or false. A fanatical message, very, very strict enforcement of party discipline, and outside funding. Now, in the American case, of course, the New Left had endless sympathetic press coverage. That's not always the case. But wherever you go, you notice that revolutions, whether they're violent or not, are created by groups like this. Fairly small, often very secretive, absolutely fanatical in the sense that they'll die for this garbage. It's usually garbage. Tightly knit. They shoot dissenters usually immediately. And they're willing to sacrifice numbers for purity. Something that the White Armies, for example, in the Russian Civil War didn't do. Their ideology, they didn't have an ideology. They were all over the place. The Bolsheviks, one of the many reasons they won, outside of the Western money and Western support, was their ideology was, it was, they were lying, you know, peace, land, and bread, you know, nonsense. But it was simple, easy to remember, and it had tons of money behind it, and the promise of stability. Taliban, relative to Afghanistan, are the good guys. They're not importing heroin. They're the only fight against it, the only warfare against it. And it shows you, most importantly, how easy the drug war can be won. The Chinese did it. You know, it doesn't take, it really doesn't take much. It takes fanatical will for a relatively small group of people. In the U.S., the drug war has failed because it's never meant to be won. So that book gets into these details. Afghanistan's in Central Asia, not the Middle East. But I actually say the Islamic world to cover it all. And it really, it's about ideology and philosophy as much as it is guns and bullets and money. And that's very important. Anyway, thank you for listening. Again, I request your support financially. And I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalists with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.